From a secret location in room 100 of 540 Jack Gibbs Boulevard, this is Craft. I'm your host, Doug Dangler. Author Carl Hoffman will be in town on March 31st with the Thurber House, discussing his latest book, Savage Harvest, a tale of cannibals, colonialism, and Michael Rockefeller's tragic quest for primitive art. Welcome to Craft, Carl Hoffman.
Thanks so much for having me.
The publicity material for Savage Harvest, your latest book, describes your interest in the story like this. The mystery of the disappearance of the scion of one of America's wealthiest dynasties stayed with Hoffman until he knew that he could not continue with other work until he undertook for himself today the same voyage that ended so horrifically decades before. So tell me a little bit about the background for the book and what held your interest in it.
Well, I'm a writer by trade and a journalist, and since I've been in my 20s, I've been traveling all over the world on assignment, and I originally started doing that right out of college, just as basically a kid with a backpack, and I heard somewhere along the lines, the story of Michael Rockefeller. I've always been fascinated by it, and it kind of never left me over the decades. As the more I traveled, and the more I always thought of, wondered what had happened to him, and imagined, especially the more I traveled, and the more I traveled to crazy remote places, that even in those distant, difficult, remote places, people were pretty kind, and that if something had really happened to him, it must have been sort of a strange occurrence, and then. A couple of years ago, I thought I'd take a little bit of a more of a look at the case, and as I did so, a couple of things stood out. One was just that he disappeared in such a crazily remote place on the southwest coast of what is now Indonesian Papua, part of the island of New Guinea, and then Dutch New Guinea, a Dutch colony. And even today, it's an incredibly remote place. I mean, 10,000 square miles, without a road, one cell tower, one grass airstrip. And there's a description from a journalist who was along for one of the search missions for Michael in 1961. And he writes just a letter to a friend, and he talks about the kind of crazy, the mud and the swamps. And he says, it's said that if a man falls down in this mud, he cannot get up without help. And I was poking around, and I knew that simply wasn't true. I mean, the Asmat people have been living there for 40,000 years and rolling in the mud and playing in the mud and carrying on their lives. And, I realized that the whole thing had become kind of a myth. And a myth that he was lost in this alien realm, that you couldn't go to and you couldn't access, and where traditional methods of investigation and money and power, lawyers and investigators were useless. And I had traveled all over the world by this time and knew that those places that appeared to be alien were often penetrable and untangleable if you had the patience and the time and actually went to them. So that's what I started doing. And, there was one other thing, and that's all of the stories about Michael's disappearance, the ones that is that refer to this rumor that he made it to shore and that he'd been killed and eaten, referenced a Dutch raid to the area, in Dutch government raid to the area in 1958. And that's all that was ever said, just that sort of this mysterious Dutch raid. And I thought, well, if there was a Dutch raid, then there ought to be records to it. And I hired a researcher in Amsterdam in the Netherlands, and he started going into the government archives. And one thing led to another, and sure enough, there had been a government raid. And then that we found out the name, the times, and all the details, and very detailed reports. And hundreds and hundreds of pages of documents that reveal what had happened to Michael.
In the materials around the book, it mentions that the Rockefeller family didn't help you on the book, and they had written their own book. I'm sort of surprised that they didn't have the money to, or that they maybe they didn't look for that sort of information themselves. So this was all new, and you discovered it.
Well, the Rockefeller family obviously had the money to to look themselves. I mean, I think there are a couple different reasons they never did. I think that, like I said, I mean, during the weeks after the search, after Michael's disappearance, the place just appeared to be so alien and impenetrable, and you know, planes swept over it, and boats combed the seas and found nothing. And the only likely explanation at the time seemed to the Dutch government and to the Rockefellers seemed to be that he had just disappeared at sea and drowned. And then ultimately the Dutch government, I mean, as it turns out, the Dutch government and the Catholic Church knew within a couple of weeks of his disappearance what had happened to him, began hearing these stories. And two missionaries on the ground who spoke the local language began pretty serious investigations and ultimately wrote long, detailed reports to the government and to their superiors in the church, naming names, who had which body parts, I mean, getting very, very specific. And those, wow. All those reports were just kept secret, and the Dutch government didn't tell the Rockefellers. So the Rockefellers never had any real knowledge, one assumes, of it. And, you know, Mary, his twin sister, wrote a book in 2012. It's mostly about her efforts to heal from the loss of her, you know, losing her twin brother. And I think the Rockefellers' feeling is that they're, you know, it's a private matter, and they just something they'd really rather not talk about in public.
Okay. You've got a, like you said, a long background of travel writing and an interest in travel that arises from when you were young, and that's one of the reasons that you want to go out and explore the world, is that that's something that's just part of your personality. Now, in agreement with your Twitter handle, Lunatic Carl, your extensive travel sounds, at least to this sort of stay-at-home interviewer, a bit like lunacy. How do you explain to others, to people like me, this insatiable curiosity you have? I'm curious about many things, but going to a place, as you describe, that does not in any way appeal to me. It sounds like a really horrible vacation.
You know, it's hard for me to explain. I guess I feel, like you said, you know, I do have an insatiable curiosity. And I'm, you know, I was brought up from an early age. I mean, I read a lot, and parents who loved books and loved sort of seeing the world through the page. And I, you know, to me, it wasn't enough just to read about places. I wanted to see them, touch them, smell them, go there, experience them. And I've always felt that way. And I think that's, you know, an important part of living, and is to know and to see. And once I started doing that, the more places I went, the more both the bigger the world seemed rather than the smaller, but also, you know, I started seeing the world as this place, even, you know, especially the remotest corners and crevices, as real places, not mythical places, and places you could go to, and with, you know, mostly often with a little bit of care and taking the time to do it, you know, really get to know people there. And I, you know, going to Asmat, as I did, I made two trips of 2 months each, so for a total of 4 months into this remote world. It was hard. I mean, Asmat's one of the hardest places I've ever been. You know, it's very hot, very, you know, a lot of flies, it's hard to live in a village with no power, no plumbing, no stores, you know, eating sago palm and sago beetles and rice, and, you know, sitting with people who really don't do anything and don't have any knowledge of the outside world. You sort of sit there and smoke cigarettes all day. I mean, I'm not a smoker, but you kind of have to there. Every conversation and ritual is greased with tobacco. And, you know, you just sit there and you learn. You know, that's what I do. I sit there for days, weeks, if I have to, getting to know people and letting them get to know me. And then so I can ask them questions, you know, deep questions. This was a murder that happened, and, you know, an issue of cannibalism, and the Asmat are not cannibals any longer. They're, you know, nominally Catholics, although they have multiple wives, and are, you know, see the world as a place full of their native spirits, but you know, to hang out with them is a kind of a beautiful thing, and it just takes a, you know, you have to kind of recalibrate, you know, your sense of desire and what your own personal needs are for a time.
So you, on your website, you describe you've got three children who roll their eyes at you a lot. And I'm wondering if part of that eye rolling is related to things like what you just said. You know, you've got to recalibrate. You've got to sit there, smoke a lot of cigarettes when you're not even a smoker, so that you get to know the people so that they'll trust you and tell you their story. Because at that same time that, you know, you're earning that trust over days and weeks, you're away from all the other people in your life. Tell me about sort of that aspect of being a writer and how it relates to the three children that roll their eyes at you or other people that might question what you're doing.
Well, I'm still trying to figure that one out. when I say three children, you know, I mean, to us, they're our children are our children forever. You know, at this point, they're young adults, 23, 21, and 19. And, you know, I mean, I say they rolled their eyes at me because to them, you know, I just do what I do, and I've always done it. And, you know, they just shrug their shoulders at it. I mean, like, Dad's gone. He's going to Papua New Guinea, or he's going to Azmat, or he's taking a bus across Afghanistan in the middle of a war or something. And you know, I try to bring them cool stuff home from adventures. And even that, they're kind of getting a nerd to. you know, they, you know, and the people will sort of, you know, if I do a book signing or something, people come and they want to get the book signed or they want to meet me. And my kids are like, "Huh, you know, he's just like, you know, goofy dad." Mm-hmm. He goes, he comes, he does this. It's just, you know, for them, it's nothing. But as they get older, they actually, I think they're starting to get more and more interested. It's funny and interesting. And, you know, I'm looking forward to actually wandering the world with them a little bit.
Okay, so they didn't necessarily inherit the same travel interest gene, if such a thing exists.
Well, that remains to be seen. I think, you know, they've been a lot of places for kids. I mean, they've been to Nicaragua and Peru and Europe, and my oldest daughter lived in Rome for a year. But they're, I don't know, they don't, I think it's, you know, it's like, you know, kids of parents, you know, if your parents have a lot of tattoos, then maybe you don't want a tattoo. It's not cool. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if your parents love to travel and go sort of to extreme places, then, you know, as a kid, you know, your idea of identifying yourself is maybe to not do that. I think my son wants to explore the world a bit more. Okay. And we'll see what happens.
So the adage, if your dad brings you home a lot of petrified monkey paws, you're probably not going to want to give your kids petrified monkey paws. That's the kind
that
of
seems to be the case. So, like I said, I'm not convinced that they're not going to all suddenly kind of drop everything and start wandering.
Right. What my last question is maybe a common one for a travel writer, but I think a really valuable one for people who are tuning in. What is the travel book, the travel site, the authority that you think is best to consult for doing a lot of traveling? Say if you're going to Europe this summer, as various folks might be doing, is there a place that you still go back to for the down and dirty or most detailed sort of analysis of a place that you're going to visit?
Well, that's a hard question. Well, I mean, it depends on where you're going and what you're doing. I mean, you know, in the end, the source that I use the most is just the Lonely Planet guidebooks, and there's a discussion board sponsored by Lonely Planet called Thorntree, and that's, you know, there's a lot of people out there wandering crazy remote, I mean, everywhere from Paris and Rome and Washington, D.C. to the Amazon, and people are writing in and saying, giving sort of up-to-the-minute reports about hotels and hostels and other buses are running and, you know, sort of up-to-date local on-the-ground information. And I think that's pretty useful.
Okay. Well, Carl Hoffman, I thank you very much for talking to me today on Craft, and we look forward to your March 31st visit to the Thurber House, and we'll have plenty of information about that on the website, and we'll be linking in on Twitter with you and watching your travels as you go from place to place before you come to the most exotic destination of all, Columbus, Ohio.
I can't wait. I'll see you there.
Thank you. For more information from my guests, visit www.craftheshow.com. This is Doug Dangler. Until next time, be creative.